Hello everyone, welcome to the Road to Pride podcast. My name's Jo.
And I'm Julie.
And each week we'll be talking to brilliant people from across the LGBT community about what Pride means to them.
We need reforms on the Gender Recognition Act. We should be recognising lots of different gender identities. And I am horrified that government has not even recognised it, is not making any statement about it, apart from rolling back on it.
The intersectionality is so strong, and kids will pick up these links of oppression and, you know, how things have got better, but there's still more to do, and how it relates to them in school and, you know, and behaviour and caring for each other. You know, there's so many really easy links.
So this is where we do our little preamble. So this week is Schools Pride Week, Julie. I think it's our second Norfolk Schools Pride Week.
It's one of the things that makes me proudest about LGBT plus work, because I just know from my own experience, we didn't hear the word lesbians at school. And to not have a kind of identity or to talk about sexual orientation just felt like a massive gap. I mean, I'm not sure if your experience was different as you are younger, but, you know...
Thanks for letting the listeners know.
There's that awful video and that diagram in biology, and that's all we had. So, yeah, we had to find our information out from, you know, libraries and our own experiences. So, yeah. Really great. So, Schools Week, just to raise the bar, it's fantastic listening to Nick and Ellie opine about all the fantastic work they do in schools. And hearing that it's patchy still is hard, but, you know, they are really leading the way, and hopefully Norwich Pride is playing its part. But you were quite involved in Schools Week last week, weren't you, as education lead, I think, Jo?
Yeah, last year I was education lead for Pride before being chair this year. And, yeah, I really loved it, actually. Working with schools was fantastic, and it was the first year that we'd done that. And I think what's so brilliant is hearing from teachers who really care about this and really understand why it makes such a, you know, why it makes such a difference. I think you're right about... You know, when I went to school, it wasn't talked about. Nobody talked about it, apart from, you know, the occasional slur in the school, or, you know, gay being used as a derogatory term for things that were just uncool. No, nobody talked about being gay, being LGBT. I was the only gay person I knew, so like, it was just not a thing. And it's so important. And I think, you know, what comes across in the chat that we had with Nick and Ellie is that, you know, it really is life-saving work. It changes people's lives. And I think there are a few examples in the chat of where maybe kids, queer kids, are coming from families maybe that who aren't supportive, and that if it's done right, they can actually find a supportive environment at school, which just seems kind of unthinkable for me, that I, you know, and I'm so pleased that for this generation there's an opportunity. I mean, that's not to say that that's the case in every school, of course, and that's, sure, it's not everybody's experience, but it's really heartening to think that it might be in some schools.
Definitely. I mean, imagine having your own, well, not your own, a shared LGBT plus, like, a Pride youth network. How empowering that would be. I think that whole school approach, but the fact is kind of not mandated still worries me. And there's obviously a lot of work to do still in terms of making sure that it's consistent.
Absolutely. And we've set up a teachers network as well at Pride, at Norwich Pride, for to create a professional network of people working in schools across Norfolk who are doing this work and who want to see this, you know, get better in schools. And that's been brilliant. So if you're listening to this and you think, I'd like my school to be part of Schools Pride Week, you can email education@norwichpride.org.uk. And if you would like to join the teachers network, it's the same email address, education@norwichpride.org.uk. And you can be part of it, which is just great. And we'd love to have you on board. It would be fantastic.
And I think even in this virtual world, we've already seen people baking rainbow cakes or creating visual, you know, we want stuff for our virtual Pride on the 25th of July as well, you know.
Yeah, that's really true, actually. Yeah, great. Good idea to plug Virtual Pride. We should do that. That's very soon, on the 25th of July. It's really exciting. And we want, yeah, as many people as possible to take part in it.
So shall we listen, Jo, to the professionals on this subject and see what they've got to say and what advice they can give out?
I absolutely think we should.
Let's do it.
Hello, my name's Ellie and I am the CEO of Educate and Celebrate. Now, what we like to do is like to help you embed gender identity and sexual orientation into the fabric of your school, because we're all about building a future of inclusion and social justice.
Yeah, and my name's Nick, really good to be here, and I'm an assistant head in a secondary school in Norfolk, and one of my jobs there is around equality and another one is around safeguarding, so they're both kind of a bit relevant to tonight, keeping young people safe and happy. And also I'm a trustee of Norwich Pride and the education lead.
Thanks, Nick. We've got quite a lot to cover in our time today, and I'm really looking forward to getting into some of the issues. What might be useful is for us to start with a bit of contextualising. I know that people listening, we might have teachers, people who work in education listening, but for some people, it's been a while since they were. So what do you think the current issues are facing teachers, and particularly the legacy of Section 28? And for anyone listening who doesn't know what Section 28 is, this was a piece of legislation introduced by the Conservative government in the late 80s. Essentially what it meant was that teachers couldn't talk about in schools anything to do with quote unquote promoting homosexuality. So what do you think the legacy of that is in schools now, and what are the current issues facing teachers?
Yeah, I think one of the first things to say is the legacy of this was really long. And Thatcher's exact words, if I remember rightly, are we shouldn't be teaching young people they have an inalienable right to be gay. I mean, just imagine that. We shouldn't be teaching young people they have a right to be gay. It kind of seems worse, you know, even looking back at it now. The most damaging thing, I think, about it was that it just left this cloud, you know, even after Section 28 was repealed, it left a cloud over education for so long of teachers not wanting to feel that, you know, they were doing the wrong thing by talking about it. And teachers, I think, you know, if people, you know, tell us that we can do something, if they give us the information we need, if we're properly trained and skilled, you know, teachers will be happy to do it. Teachers want young people to feel supported, but it was that uncertainty that was such an issue. So I think in terms of where we are now, I think that's much better. I think if you polled teachers, I think most people would say, yep, we should be talking about this. And the new SRE curriculum certainly will help with that. But actually, I guess my main question is, how much of it is a priority in every school? How much of it is related to whether there's a good activist in a school or an out LGBT person? And that's not good enough, because that just leaves it down to chance, doesn't it? That's what I think. I think it's patchy, and we need to make sure that every child gets the support and the inclusive curriculum they need.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I completely agree with what you're saying. It's so much easier when it's directed from the top. If this is government-led, then we're going to be in a much better place. But still, we have the new legislation from the DfE around compulsory relationships and sex education that still says that we should be consulting with parents around this, which is quite an unusual thing to say, because we have been implementing curriculums that are inclusive of religion, of age, of marriage, of pregnancy, and lots of all the other protected characteristics without having any consultations with parents. So why in this context, when we are talking about gender identity and sexual orientation, is there still a fear? And I totally believe that is a lot to do with the legacy of Section 28, because we've got the case of our young people who are not born with prejudice, that they learn it, unfortunately. Our kids are not born sexist, racist, homophobic, transphobic. You know, they're learning prejudice. And if they're learning it, well, guess what? They can all unlearn it. But yet the parents, potentially, and the teachers and the grown-ups as a whole have not gone through this process, and there still is that legacy of can we do this, can we not? And that's just a lack of understanding on their part. And if you speak to any teacher, any school, what their biggest fear is a fear of the parents' reaction. Now, for us, if this came from government and said, we have to be inclusive of this and it's compulsory, then brilliant, that's all over the curriculum. And if Ofsted put it in their criteria on all the teacher training organisations, so all the initial teacher training provisions, we're all talking to each other, then we'd be in a much better place, because it's still not part of our qualified teacher status. It's not compulsory. And that is a real shame. I think that's where the massive gap is at this point.
So do you think that consultation is almost a green light to create a kind of backlash against ensuring that the LGBT plus protective characteristics are absolutely embedded into the curriculum? But I thought, maybe incorrectly, that it was going to be part of the compulsory RSE curriculum in September. Is that not actually the case then?
It is compulsory, yes. But the stage we're not at is where all staff are trained and ready. So new teachers coming into the profession are not trained and ready to deliver, and neither are staff that are existing within schools. You know, in the most forward-thinking schools, you know, they get training to help them roll this out within their curriculum. And we've got to remember that this is just not about rolling this out in your PHSE lessons and a little bit in science. This is every teacher's responsibility. So it can't just come through that way. It has to come through every teacher in every classroom.
I'm going to be a bit more optimistic about the consultation. I mean, I think there is definitely a route that it could go down the negative way that Julie kind of describes. But actually, you know, I think schools could turn this on its head, and it could be an opportunity to actually try and engage families about the curriculum, because that's really important too. And I have to say, the kind of advice that we've got from Norfolk is really supportive in terms of this, and they said yes, it is a consultation, but actually this is what is in the curriculum, and it's a chance for parents to feedback, and it's a chance for, you know, you to kind of explain it to parents, but this is what's in the curriculum, and that's good. Joe, I just wanted to, while we're talking about current issues facing teachers, I just wanted to flag up really quickly, COVID is an issue for teachers, and it is an issue for our LGBT youth as well, and I just wanted to flag that for many young people at home, potentially in difficult domestic situations, or at the very least isolated from their friends, that's another barrier at the moment. But I still think, as we'll get onto later, we can do some good work remotely.
So thinking about queering the curriculum and what that means, and can you tell us why this is so important?
I think this is really important. And when I look back at my own education, I went to a boys' school in Kent, one of the kind of old-fashioned grammar schools, and it was really old-fashioned in every single sense. It kind of looked like a castle, and the curriculum was really old-fashioned as well. You know, if you wrote a book about a kind of old-fashioned secondary school, it would have my school on the front. And that there was bullying, and I wasn't able to really kind of be myself. But actually, the most important factor, I think, in me feeling uncomfortable as a sort of young queer teenager was just the idea that I didn't see other people around me, that, you know, that I didn't see people that I could kind of look up to. So both in terms of teachers, there was nobody out in my school, both teachers and pupils, and also I didn't see myself in the curriculum. This doesn't need to be difficult. It can just be as simple as saying, okay, we're doing some poetry, Carol Ann Duffy, let's look at who Carol Ann Duffy is, you know, let's look at who she is as a person, let's look at her role as poet laureate, you know, and just labeling it. Ditto Alan Turing, you know, so much of history behind him and his accomplishments. I mean, it's just making sure that the curriculum is diverse, and we don't miss really simple opportunities just to flag things up.
You're absolutely right, Nick. I love all of that. And you have touched upon one of the favourite words, which is usualising. Which is what we want to encourage. And, you know, and it's not as difficult as we think it is. But it starts with language, really. Language is key to all of this. You know, how are our young people greeted every day? How are the staff greeted? Are we saying, hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls? Or are we saying, hello, everyone, hello, friends? You know, I mean, a lot of this comes back to gender, and gender has become a little bit of an enemy. So which is why I recommend bringing our kids up in a more gender-free or gender-neutral way and developing gender-neutral schools. Because, you know, the only issue that people have with people who are identifying as LGB is that they fancy people of the same gender as them. Now, if we took gender out of that, we could love who we wanted. Would we have sexism if we brought our kids up in a gender-free world? Well, no, we couldn't, because we would all have had equal opportunity. And would we have transphobia? Well, no, because we could identify as who we were from the get-go. So breaking down the constraints that we put on gender, breaking the binary, as I like to call it, is a really important thing to do. And like Nick said, it's through simple things like books. You know, what literature are you reading in your lessons? Well, let's read books about families with two mums, two dads, a trans dad. Let's say to our kids, well, you can play with any toys that you want to, and get rid of phrases like boys will be boys, because that is one of the worst ones. No, boys will not be boys. They will take responsibility for their behaviour just like any other person would. You know,
man, we can up, Ellie.
And so we can no longer be falling into the traps of this binary language.
It's really interesting hearing you talk about that and the sort of breadth of this issue and how it can be, you know, it's not just about what is taught in the classroom, it's about the environment that you create in your school. And I think that's really a good way to look at it. I remember a couple of years ago when there was a lot of hoo-ha in the press about the protests that were happening outside a school in Birmingham. I remember one line of defence, I suppose, that I saw was people saying, you know, we're not teaching kids to be gay because you can't teach kids to be gay. And I agree with that. You know, I mean, obviously that is the case. But it kind of makes me wonder, like, what would be so bad if that was possible? I just think there's this sense of, like, when we come out in support of inclusive education and creating curricula that aren't homophobic, that's not transphobic, that's, you know, usualizing queer people, I think some of the maybe the internalized homophobia that we feel as a community sort of comes to the fore a bit, and it feels quite defensive and like we have to, you know, we have to say no, we're not teaching people this terrible thing. And so to hear you talk about it in such positive terms, I think is really, really important. And it's really refreshing, I think.
You know, I think this whole kind of promote idea is actually quite kind of pernicious, isn't it? You know, that we're going to go in and recruit people. We see it now with the whole trans debate, don't we? You know, that the idea is that somebody even mentions, you know, the fact that they're a bit dissatisfied with gender norms, and all of a sudden we've, you know, performed a surgical operation in school or something. You know, that's kind of how you've that's how you'd read it in the Daily Mail, isn't it? But, you know, it isn't like that at all. It's about giving young people facts and allowing them to explore in a safe space. You know, that's all it is. And I just wanted to mention, you know, thinking of the teaching side of things, the importance of staff training, because all of that stuff that Ellie mentions, and we need to educate young people about the terms in which young people describe themselves, so trans, you know, and looking at some cisgender transitioning, all of those terms that are actually quite difficult for some people. So that needs to start with educating the teachers, because unless the teachers are confident, then the young people won't be confident either.
One thing that's occurred to me as we've been talking about the curriculum is, I suppose, the additional aspect to that. So what happens in the classroom, what's in the curriculum? And you were talking before about the wider environment. But in terms of the negative aspects, so the bullying that LGBT kids might experience in schools, is that addressed through the curriculum? Is that addressed somewhere else? Is that's obviously a staff training issue as well. Like, how does that link to the queering the curriculum piece?
Bullying is just the end result of not being educated. It's really that simple. So we could spend lots of time troubleshooting bullying if we wanted. And a lot of that bullying is generally done in a perceived way. Kids are being bullied because of their perceived sexual orientation or their perceived gender identity, not necessarily because they are. And it's getting those two things right first. So educating the curriculum, as we know, as soon as staff do that, then your bullying statistics go right down.
And education is really key, both for staff and students. You know, and you can kind of see the panic you know, where when a homophobic incident might happen, and staff just kind of think, oh, panic, you know, and you know, sanctions have their part, but actually we know that you get a much better result from education. You know, that's the way to solve the issue. And, you know, taking restorative approaches. And so I think it all starts from having clear policies, you know, and schools knowing exactly what to do, because these things are always difficult. They're always emotive. There's often a shade of grey. And actually, I think if schools have got clear policies which involve education and, you know, more reactionary measures to deal with issues that take part in school, then that really helps staff to have clarity about what they should be doing. Because, like I say, staff want to get it right, but they need that leadership to be able to do it in the heat of the moment.
So in terms of capturing the breadth of intersectionality in the approach to LGBT plus inclusion and usualising in the curriculum, how do we ensure that there is inclusivity of people of colour, of queer people of colour, and trans inclusivity? How do we make sure that that happens, as well as the broad approach to queering the curriculum?
Through exactly what every teacher is teaching within their lessons. And I guess I used to call it the dead white man syndrome, which was teachers repeatedly teaching just about dead white men. But now we have better words for it. We can say decolonizing the curriculum. And that is something that we've always advocated for. You know, it was really quite interesting. We do a curriculum audit with each school that we work with. And then one of the primary schools, in the art curriculum, quite unbelievably, were just teaching about dead white men, and they were quite horrified. So we sat there and thought, well, let's see who we can talk about. So first person we came up with was Frida Kahlo, for instance, because, you know, she's a woman, she's Mexican, she identified as bisexual, and also had a disability.
I think this is a really good example of how schools shouldn't try and do one equality strand on its own. I think there's a lot more power if actually dealing with all of the equality strands is a regular part of what schools do. I kind of always get a bit bemused when schools all of a sudden decide, oh, well, it's, you know, it's February, let's do a gay assembly, you know, let's do an LGBT History Month assembly. You know, that doesn't really work, because the kids get that it's a bit kind of put on. They think it's a bit strange. Actually, if you're regularly doing these things, you know, if you know that, you know, in October you'll do a Black History Month assembly, if they know that in February you'll do an LGBT History Month assembly, if they know in March you'll look at International Women's Day, and so on and so on, and mark the many other kind of events there are, Holocaust Memorial Day, you know, events around disability, you know, then it does become part of the fabric of the school, and it becomes a lot more believable, because actually intersectionality is so strong, and kids will pick up these links of oppression and, you know, how things have got better but there's still more to do, and how it relates to them in school, and, you know, and behaviour and caring for each other. But, you know, this is a really crucial time, you know, focusing specifically on Black Lives Matter and what schools can do now. I think this is a turning point. And I think not only, you know, will it prove to be so in terms of teachers, I think the pupils will demand it. You know, I think you can see now more students saying, actually, what we had at school, you know, in terms of the curriculum and in terms of racist bullying, it wasn't good enough. You know, we want better. I'm at the moment, penning an open letter that Norwich Pride has thankfully signed up to, and I'm actually looking for head teachers to sign up to that, and it's got five pledges about, and one of those is about decolonizing the curriculum. And I think within that space, you know, that we can improve things for LGBT people as well.
If parents of LGBT kids or LGBT parents like feel maybe that their school could do more, what kind of things would you suggest that either they suggest to their school, or that they can find out themselves and put forward? What steps can be taken if, as a parent, you think your school could or might want to do more?
Yes, if I was a parent and I was sending my child to a new school, there'd be lots of checks that I would be making with that school. So first, I would be looking at their website and I would be seeing what inclusion work, because I would expect a school to have an inclusion or a diversity or equality, equity page of some sort with on their website. So I'd be having a really good look through that to start off with. I would then be downloading their policies and having a look at what's in their inclusion policy and their equal opportunities, to just to make sure that it does include the language from the Equality Act 2010, to make sure that they have provision for all different kinds of young people. And also having a meeting with maybe one of the teachers or senior leadership team to see if the teachers have had any training at all on this is a really good thing to do. And you can look at the curriculum online. A lot of lessons and a lot of schools, well, they'll have examples of what they're teaching within that curriculum. You can look at photographs of the school, so you can see, oh, is there a poster up in reception? How am I greeted? What's there? Is this an inclusive school? There's a lot on what community work they are doing. So how are they engaging? Are there lots of events that people can join? Can parents go in for coffee mornings? Are there drop-ins? So I'd be checking out those five areas of the school, first of all. So that's training and the policy, the curriculum, the environment, and how they're engaging with the community.
I can't add a lot more to that. That was a very detailed answer. I would just say, add two things. So firstly, you know, I think appearances are sometimes useful. So they can be deceiving, but actually I'm always interested to see what the school kind of puts near the front. So, you know, where do its priorities lie? You know, is it just some statistics about maths and English, or do they try and create a space that's welcoming? And sometimes that could be a smokescreen as well, you know. But actually, you know, do they have the Stonewall posters up? Do staff wear rainbow lanyards? You know, those things don't create massive change all by themselves, but they are a sign. And, you know, I think they show, you know, perhaps that the school is at least trying. Then I think Ellie went through all the other things in a lot of detail. The other thing I'd just say with my sort of wider school hat on is also, you know, what are their other approaches? You know, because it isn't just about LGBT stuff in isolation. It's also about their attitudes towards the curriculum, you know, more broadly. So do they just bang on about English and maths, or do they appreciate the arts? You know, do they talk about well-being? Do they talk about counselling provision? Do they have a wide range of clubs? You know, because LGBT stuff, again, you know, I don't think it sort of happens in isolation in a box. It's actually about safeguarding and well-being and making sure that all children are looked after.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of links quite nicely with my next thought, which is about the self-organising of young people in the school around Pride Youth Networks, for example. Is that something that your experience with Ellie, I know Educate and Celebrate have an area of work around this, but maybe start with Nick. Has your school got its own Pride Youth Network, or have you been involved in setting them up in schools across the region?
Yep, so we've got a group called Strive for Pride. Yeah, and we've been doing some work for a few years. I mentioned the stuff that we did on Gresson Hall, and we meet once a fortnight. And sometimes we just have drop-ins, and sometimes we do something a bit more formal. And we've had people, they like talking about their icons and doing little presentations about them, you know, sort of queer icons. And it can be a bit boisterous sometimes. They like it when I bring cake in, and it can all be a bit loud and messy, but it is a nice safe space for them. And actually, I'm kind of quite interested, and maybe Ellie might have some help for me here, but I'm kind of thinking about where that goes next, because as we apply to be a school of sanctuary, I'm just thinking maybe about whether we want to broaden that into a sort of wider equalities group that looks beyond just LGBT stuff, that is a safe space, but actually has that intersectional perspective. So I am looking at perhaps changing what we do. So I'm interested to see what advice Ellie can give me.
Yeah, I totally recommend that. That is exactly what started to happen with all our other groups.
There you go. That segued well.
That was just perfect, Nick. Thank you. You're absolutely right. We should be covering as a whole diversity and inclusion group, D&I group. As we're calling them these days, and which is why the word Pride fits so well. We call them Pride Youth Networks, because that covers absolutely everybody. So not about just about bringing in all the different protected characteristics, but also expanding the skills that the young people are learning. So what we've learned, we're in the fourth year of this project now, So we've sort of narrowed it down to sort of four main areas now. So what we're doing is enabling leadership in inclusive practices and decision-making processes. That's what the young people are actually doing. And then secondly, developing an awareness and a commitment to challenge all the social institutions and the environments that can sometimes present, you know, as being hostile. And then thirdly, enabling their personal development, and clearly we want to improve their self-esteem. And then that is what we found as well, has developed into work-related skills development. So they're basically project managing within the school, leadership skills, chairing responsibilities, they're influencing, negotiating, and, you know, they're campaigning and they're advocacy and presentation skills. So it's a whole ream of skills that the young people are learning when they form these Pride Youth networks.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. And, you know, obviously, like when people leave school and they head out into the wider world, the more people that we can put into, you know, universities and workplaces and colleges who understand what real diversity and inclusion is, you know, they can go on to make the world a better place in the places they study and the places they work. So it's fantastic, as well as being so important for the young people themselves who identify into those groups and feel.
I thought you were going to say, Joe, we can recruit them to help organise Norwich Pride. So we are actually going to recruit them.
Do you know what? That's a really great idea.
Well, great idea, if anyone's listening. There we go.
Yes. In terms of the future and kind of where you would like to see education for LGBT people to be in a few years' time, what does that look like to you? What's the aspiration?
Oof, that's a massive picture. Well, firstly, let's take it right back. Let's make sure that young people have got something to eat and somewhere to live. So that's a nice starting point, I think. And then we need to start looking at the laws of most of the countries. You know, if we're looking at this on a global perspective, then we've still got 70 countries where it's still illegal to be LGBT plus. So that's what we need to be looking at. And I'd like to make the world a much fairer place as a whole. So this is working globally. So taking what we've learnt from the education here, which is improving, but still could be a lot better, and taking that into the broader fields. But having better conversations with the policymakers. I mean, we haven't quite cracked that here. I couldn't let this conversation go without at least talking about the rollbacks in trans rights, which are happening at this moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is setting us back quite a long way. And I'm extremely disappointed, because we all took part in the consultation and 10,000 voices spoke and said, yes, we need reforms on the Gender Recognition Act. We should be recognising lots of different gender identities. And I am horrified that government has not even recognised it, is not making any statement about it, apart from rolling back on it, which is exactly the wrong way to go. You know, protecting women's spaces, well, that means trans women can't access women's spaces. What if they are abused? Why can't they go into a refuge? Proper checks and balances. What does that mean? Does that mean we're going to have our genitals policed before we enter into toilets? And then also protecting young trans people from making any irreversible decisions was another thing that Liz Truss said. Well, we know as educators that the younger we can get to trans people, the better, that they can, you know, access services from a younger age. It's much better for them. So it's very disappointing and setting us back. And it's embarrassing for, you know, CEOs like myself who do work with other schools globally. We work with a lot of international schools. And to have to say that the law is going backwards here is not exactly what I want to be saying. So we have got lots of conversations still to have with policymakers, and how that relates to us in our teacher training and Ofsted and government and going forwards from this point.
I would add to that three things. So number one, I'd like to see the RSE curriculum brought in with vigour in September. You know, so that due to COVID, the government has kind of said it would still like it to be put in, but it also understands if schools may not have got everything in place by September. And I guess in a way that's supportive, but I also want to make sure that it really is at the forefront of everybody's mind. And, you know, rather than seeing COVID as a reason why that might not happen, I think we should flip it on its head and say, actually, this is the best way of making sure that students come back to school and get the lesson content that will help them, you know, the recovery curriculum that they need. Secondly, I think, you know, it is that return to school and, you know, in a way that isn't obsessed with people catching up, but gives students that holistic kind of education that they need and the mental health support and the baby steps back into school. You know, that's the way that we're going to get young people caught up, by making them feel comfortable to be back in school. It shouldn't be a lottery as to, you know, which school you go to, you know, leads to different outcomes in terms of the support that you get if you're LGBT or just an LGBT ally. It should be the same everywhere. And the RSE curriculum gives us a chance to do that. And then there's the role of Ofsted. You know, in a political sense, you know, I'm deeply uncomfortable with saying, you know, I want Ofsted to go into schools and take them to task. But at the same time, they do that about everything else. So they should be doing the same, you know, around LGBT stuff if it's going to have that parity, you know, of esteem and support. You know, Ofsted came into our school in February. It was absolutely fine, but they didn't really explicitly ask me about anything to do with LGBT stuff. I told them, you know, maybe it might have come up later, but it didn't seem at the forefront of their mind. And lastly, just to echo what Ellie said, you know, complete solidarity with the trans community. I'd agree with everything she said, but I'd also add, you know, about waiting lists. And the cuts there have been recently, and far from the kind of picture that's painted that, you know, it all happens really quickly and irreversible changes happen overnight as soon as, you know, somebody even voices a concern about their identity. Actually, it takes far too long. And recent statistics said that, you know, some students are waiting over 3 years for the kind of support that they need to feel comfortable in their own skin. And that's not okay. So we can't move forward from that. So, yeah, so three things. The SRE curriculum, which I think is a great vehicle for our work, a good return to school, that with kind of recovery and mental well-being at the forefront. And thirdly, you know, solidarity and support for trans young people.
Brilliant listening to you both talk so passionately about this. Now, it would be lovely just to hear a couple of examples from you, maybe starting with you, Nick, about some positive changes you've seen, either in individuals, obviously without naming them, but, you know, what have you experienced that's been fantastic at your school or in the environment you work in?
Yeah, so a couple of particularly nice things that we've achieved, I think, are, and we did some really lovely work with the LGBT group that we've got at school with Gresson Hall Museum, and we looked at queer objects in the museum, and that's just recently gone up online, and that's really nice to see, you know, a really in-depth bit of work that our LGBT group did with the History Society. So it was kind of taking two different cross-sections of kids together, and it led to a really, really nice bit of work, and that's on the Gresson Hall's website if people want to see that, which is working positively with a local museum. But actually, I think in terms of something personal, I really want to draw on a staff thing. And I think, yeah, I talked earlier about how it too often depends on, you know, an LGBT member of staff, an activist in a school, and actually we don't want that. So I think probably the light bulb moment for me, the real great moment, was year before last, when rather than me doing the LGBT History Month assembly again, we other members of staff volunteered to do it. And I didn't lead this, they suggested it, and that's great. And so the history teacher did an amazing assembly. It's one of the best assemblies I've ever seen, about the history of disco. And it was incredible. And he went right back and looked at the birth of disco and how LGBT people were at the centre of that. And it was really intersectional. It was looking at BAME people as well. It was just Awesome. And then a maths teacher gave an assembly as well a bit later, and this was wasn't just about LGBT, it was about different forms of diversity, about how he'd been on a journey and how he'd you know, in the past had some, you know, perhaps dodgy views about it, but actually that changed, and you know, and how members of his family had changed. And I think when you feel that it's not just you, but as was said at the beginning, it's part of the fabric of the school, and that, you know, even if you left, it would still go on, you know, I think that's a really powerful moment, because it shouldn't be about individuals, it should be about whole schools. And I think that was a big moment of change for me.
Great. I've got hundreds. It's difficult to know where to start, but I love the fact Nick picked up on there that it's no longer that one teacher like Nick in the school that's doing this work. Once they, once you've modelled it and showed how effective it can be, it gives other members of staff the confidence to roll this out as well. And I think that's a really brilliant point. We do a whole campaign called hashtag moments of change, and you'll see them all over our social media, and we're just collecting them all in at the moment because it's the end of the year for our award schools, and it's brilliant. I mean, for instance, we've had this year's a trans student who unfortunately is only called by their name by their parents if they do an X number amount of chores. So we've been working with that student within our Pride Youth Network, and they've turned that into activism within the school. So they're making a positive difference themselves within the school by updating the policies, by training the staff, putting up diversity inclusion displays, holding coffee mornings, bake-offs, all that to raise awareness. And that's a really wonderful thing, because it's empowered them to make the changes. And then one that I put out yesterday, which I loved, which was a year five coming out in an assembly. The teacher was holding an assembly just about their new equality code. And the pupil just said, yes, you shouldn't make fun of gay people because my brother does that to me and I'm gay. Mm. So, and the teacher said, oh, sorry, could you say that again? And he did, and he just announced it to the whole school. And the teacher said, well, nobody sniggered, nobody gasped, nobody whispered under their breath, and he was just immediately accepted by everyone. And this was because they've done the work. This is like a year down the line, and he was really proud of all the staff and children. But what that facilitated then was conversations at home, because the young pupil came for a chat afterwards to the teacher and said he hadn't told his parents. So the teacher facilitated that meeting with the parents, and there was initial friction, but they worked through it as a family and a school, and then that pupil's now really, really happy. And that's what this work is all about, that our kids can be confident in being themselves within school. And the more research we do, we are finding that the pupils are more likely to come out at school because they feel confident rather than coming out at home. And that is credit to, you know, us as educators.
Thank you both so much for talking to us today. You've been brilliant, and I feel confident that with you two involved in schools, that the future is bright for LGBT young people and education.
And we can do it on our own. It's fine.
I just wanted to say, yeah, thanks again so much for talking to us. And we are part of, we're releasing this podcast as part of Norwich Pride's Schools Pride Week, which starts on the 13th of July. And there are schools across Norfolk who are doing all sorts of LGBT focused activity and celebrating Pride and celebrating their LGBT young people. So if you are listening to this and you want to take part in that, email education@norwichpride.org.uk and we can point you in the right direction, and you can join our teachers network as well, which Nick is leading, and forms a network of teachers across Norfolk who want to meet each other and to learn from each other about how to make schools the best environment possible for LGBT people. So can I say thanks again to Ellie and to Nick for joining us.
Thank you,
that was lovely.
Well, that brings us to the end of our special edition of the Road to Pride podcast, all about education and schools. This week, like we said, is Norwich Pride Schools Pride Week. And if you're taking part, please email us with the stuff that you're doing. We'd love to hear from you. And for those of you who are listening and would like to take part, You can do so by emailing education@norwichpride.org.uk and we can sign you up to our mailing list. That email address is also the place for you to join the Teachers Network, which is a brilliant place to meet other LGBT teachers and allies who are doing work in this area. Just email education@norwichpride.org.uk. In Norfolk, we are really lucky to have the Norfolk LGBT Project, and they do so much for the LGBT community here, from youth groups to support groups, and they also work with schools through their Educating with Pride Award. They can come into your school and work with you and collaborate on making your school a brilliant place for LGBT young people. Just search Norfolk LGBT Project online to find out more. There's also Educate and Celebrate. You just heard from Ellie on the podcast. They are a national organisation with loads of experience of working across the country on improving the lives of LGBT people in schools. So you can find them by searching Educate and Celebrate online. There are lots of people doing fantastic work to make schools a better place for young LGBT people, and we know how important and life-saving that work is. Okay, I think that's it. We are so close to Virtual Pride now. You can find out more about that on our website, norwichpride.org.uk. That's the 25th of July. We'll be streaming it on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, anywhere you can find it. And we really want you to be part of it. So go to our website to find out how you can take part. Next week, we are talking about, believe it or not, Dolly Parton and the queer perspective on her music with a PhD student who's looking into this, and he's fantastic, and we're really excited to share that with you. So hit subscribe or follow on whichever platform works for you, and you'll get that next episode of the Road to Pride podcast onto your phone without you even having to do anything, which I think is a pretty good deal. The Road to Pride podcast is produced by Norwich Pride, and music is provided by Jess Morgan. Thanks very much, Jess.